Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. In this first hour of the show today, we'll be talking about politics in Mexico. On July 2nd, voters in Mexico will go to the polls to elect a new president. There are a number of candidates running, but the two leaders appear to be a man named Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who is the former mayor of Mexico City. He is the candidate of the PRD, the Party of Democratic Revolution. That's a center-left party. His leading opponent, Felipe Calderón, he is the candidate of the National Action Party, the PAN. It's a center-right party. It is the party of the current president, Vicente Fox. He served Mr. Fox as energy minister. And the two of them at this point seem to be running neck and neck, depending on what sort of poll you look at. One or the other may be ahead. In this part of the show, we'll be talking a little bit about who these two men are, who their constituents are, what they have said that they would do if elected, what that means for Mexico, and perhaps also what that means for the United States. And our guest is James McCann. He is Associate Professor of Political Science at Purdue University, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The number, if you'd like to call in, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That is good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call, if you're listening on the air or if you're listening on the Internet somewhere around the United States, you may use the toll-free line. That is 800-222-9455. Once again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. And that toll-free line, 800-222-9455. At any point here, people are welcome to call with questions. The only thing that we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief and we ask that so that we can get in as many calls as possible and keep the program moving along. Professor McCann, hello.
Hi, David. Thanks for the invitation.
Well, we certainly appreciate you giving us some of your time. I'm not sure what the most recent story I have seen about how the polling is going, but it does seem to be the case that from one day to the next, from one poll to the next, it either says one man has a slight lead, the other man has a slight lead. From what you've seen, are we still saying, is the headline still that the race at this point is too close to call?
Oh, yes, it's definitely too close to call for a couple of reasons. Excuse me. Not only are the two front runners, as you said before, López Obrador and Calderón, sort of in a statistical dead heat, but we don't know what the turnout factor is going to be either, which makes sort of forecasting a little bit problematic, just like we see in the States.
Well, if we went out and we did go out on the streets in Mexico City or any place else in Mexico and ask people, is this something that's really important to you? Are you following this? Could you tell me what the two candidates stand for? Do you think that the future of Mexico, the direction the country will take, is at stake and would change dramatically if either López Obrador or Mr. Calderón was elected? Would people answer in the affirmative to all of that?
Well, I think what you'd find is, a sort of large pocket of disinterestedness or apathy, maybe a third to 40% or so may tell you, at least at the outset, that they're paying very little attention to what's going on. And that's sort of typical. Many of these people may ultimately turn out to vote for one reason or another. But if you ask them, say, to name the candidate's slogans or to place the candidates along some issue spectrum, you're going to find a lot of fuzziness out there.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about Mr. Fox. Now, when he was elected, this was very significant because it was the first time that an opposition party had managed to elect a president. For something like 70 years before that, one political party, the Institutional Revolutionary Party, it's known by its initials, PRI, the PRI, had run the country. So the breaking of the lock on power of the PRI, this was very significant. It was an historic sort of event in Mexico. And so when Mr. Fox was elected, he said he intended to do a number of things, including to try to stimulate and improve the Mexican economy and deal with the issue of employment or unemployment. There were a number of things that he talked about doing. If we simply look at what it is he said he would have liked to do 6 years ago and what he has managed to achieve, how well would you say that Mr. Fox has done?
Well, I think there is definitely an achievement gap, and that I guess you can account for that gap in a couple of different ways. The first thing you got to note is that in any democracy, there's a tendency for candidates to overpromise. And, you know, whether we're talking about Kerry and Bush or Vicente Fox. And in 2000, Vicente Fox made many claims. One of the things that I remember, it really made the news all over the place, was that he could settle things with Subcomandante Marcos in 15 minutes. You know, just the idea of getting together person to person to negotiate the way you would if you were negotiating a business deal, because Fox's background was, among other things, he was an executive with the Coca-Cola company. And so he sort of came across almost in a Ross Perot type way of, you know, we'll just, you know, bring out the experts, get it done, move on to some other problem. And of course, you know, that was never a believable claim at the time, problems are much more significant when you actually try to govern. So there were many claims made about economic improvement, and his main argument in 2000 was, you know, change. That's what he named his movement, was the Alliance for Change, and he took change as just, you know, the mechanism through which all good things come. And democracy over the long run does tend to produce good things because there is accountability, there, you know, popular checking and so on office holders, and that usually results in good policy. But it's really over the long run, and there's a lot of variation day to day. And so what's happened is Fox has gotten thwarted in a number of areas. In terms of the economy, certainly in terms of negotiating better hemispheric relationships. Nobody could have foreseen 9/11 during the Mexican 2000 election, but that certainly changed the entire tone of North American relations. And certainly more recently with the immigration issue catching fire in the United States, that has put a wrinkle in terms of Fox's foreign policy as well. So there are a number of things that as I say, have thwarted Fox. Oh, he's also had trouble dealing with his Congress that tends to assert itself once in a while, certainly much more than during the old pre-days. And it's a divided Congress, much like in the States. They have issues with gridlock and all the rest. So Fox has discovered that you know, talk can be very easy and cheap, but then when you actually try to build governing coalitions and make policies, well, that's a much greater challenge. Now, that all said, Fox today has approval ratings in Mexico that would make George W. Bush very happy. The majority of Mexicans support Fox. You know, he's got rather high approval ratings, somewhere 60-ish, give or take. So he's closing out his term on more of a positive note, and that may be at least an indirect feature here of Calderon sort of coming up in the last few months as he did.
Mm-hmm. Let me just very quickly introduce again the guest for this hour of Focus 580, James McCann. He is Associate Professor of Political Science at Purdue, and we're talking here about Mexican politics and the upcoming presidential election. That's July 2nd. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I'd like to have you talk a little bit more about the two leading candidates. Maybe we'll just start with Mr. Calderon. He is the candidate of the PAN, the National Action Party, which is Mr. Fox's party. He served as the energy minister. He was not the candidate preferred by Vicente Fox. That was the interior minister, Santiago Creel, but Mr. Calderon was more successful in the series of primaries, and so he is the candidate. Can you give us a sort of a thumbnail sketch of who he is and something of his take on the basic issues?
Sure. He's the youngest of the major candidates. He's 43 years old, Harvard educated. And you might say that he, in terms of the Pan Party, he comes from a sort of dynasty, which, again, might be familiar to Americans, given that our own president comes out of a political family. His father was an active official with the PAN party. Calderón himself comes from the Mexican state of Michoacán, which is in the central west part of the country. And over the last, since getting the nomination, he's focused on a number of issues having to do with economic development. He's promised to build new oil refineries and to expand health care. He's really tried to adopt the sort of clean hands image. That's, in fact, one of the slogans of his campaign is he's the clean candidate. He comes across, if you've seen pictures of him, he looks, he's got sort of a receding hairline. One newspaper reported that they actually Photoshop or pencil in hair for him to clean up his image a little bit. He's got glasses it looks maybe a little professorial, in a sense, and so the sort of clean hands image might be a good fit for him, or at least the image might be a good fit for that slogan. He's also raised over the last several months, directly and indirectly, the issue of stability for the country. One of the things that does differentiate the Mexican electorate from the American electorate is that Mexicans tend to be more conservative in the classical small c sense than Americans. By that I mean there's a certain risk averseness in Mexico that you don't see in the United States, I don't believe. What I mean by that is the ruling party in the old days, as you said, the pre-party that ruled Mexico for 70 years, one of its major claims from the days of the Mexican Revolution or immediately after the revolution was that it could keep order. It could keep the lid on. It could be the main provider of social goods and incorporate different groups as necessary into the political regime. And that counted for a lot in Mexico, if we remember, all of the bloodshed in the early 20th century in Mexico. So the need for order, I think, is much more profound in Mexico than in the States. Mm. And so what we've seen, one little factoid that I put in my notes here I wanted to mention, there's a marvelous little survey question that's been asked on again, off again in different polls in Mexico, asking people to pick one of these survey choices. Do you think it's better to have the devil that you know or the saint that you don't yet know? Okay, we have a similar kind of saying in English, and the idea is, are you content even if you're not totally happy now? Do you still want to keep with the status quo, or do you want to risk things with the potential of things improving? And about 40% or so of the electorate in these polls will say better to have the devil they know, and so it's an electorate that really tends to be more, as I say, conservative in that classical sense. And what Calderón has tried to do is link Andrés Manuel López Obrador with social instability or, he might not be able to govern effectively or he'll rule in an authoritarian manner. There have been linkages to Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, and if coming from the Calderón camp, they've tried to link López Obrador to that style of leadership, and to suggest he represents a risk to the social stability of the country.
Hmm. Well, there, as you say, the Calderón camp has tried to paint López Obrador as some kind of a wild-eyed radical, and he is to the left of Calderon, that's for sure. But I think that a lot of people say that he is not as much. He's not a leftist in the mold of Hugo Chavez or maybe even of Lula da Silva, and that people don't. I think the López Obrador supporters say, look, his focus, if he's elected president of Mexico, is going to be Mexico and to try to improve the lives of Mexicans and try to improve the economy of Mexico. And you don't have to worry that you would be electing somebody like that. Given the fact that the PRD is a left-leaning party, hold on a second here. We have some severe weather in our area this morning, and we have a weather warning that we have to pass on to people, so let's do that. Here's our meteorologist, Ed Kieser.
Thank you, David. The National Weather Service in Romeoville has issued a severe thunderstorm warning for the southern half of Iroquois County in east-central Illinois until 11:15 a.m. As of a few minutes ago, National Weather Service radar indicating a line of severe thunderstorms extending from 7 miles southwest of Buckley to Paxton. And the storms are moving east at 35 miles per hour and will be pushing through the area around Buckley, Cisna Park, Claytonville, Milford, and Wellington. And specifically, Buckley about 10:22 a.m., which is now, Cisna Park by 10:30, Claytonville by 10:35, Milford by 10:50, and Wellington by 10:50. And these storms are producing some damaging winds, 60 to 75 miles per hour. We've had reports of that already, and they can push trucks off the highway. They can cause damage to weak structures and, of course, knock down tree limbs and power lines. So repeating, a severe thunderstorm warning is now in effect for the southern half of Iroquois County until 11:15. We continue to have a severe thunderstorm warning for the southern portions of Ford County until 10:45. Most of the action is now along and east of I-57 in Ford County. So the Gibson City area and Elliott, they're past it now. And the leading edge of the strong storms is already to near Milford and Wellington. And there's also strong storms pushing into northern Vermilion County, just to the west of Hoopston, some around Rankin, also northeastern Champaign County with some strong storms. No warnings on them as yet. But the southern half of Iroquois County and really southeastern Ford County under severe thunderstorm warnings. And a watch out for much of the area until 2 p.m. We'll have more later.
All right. Thanks, Ed. And definitely we'll keep you informed of what's going on with the weather. Do keep in mind that there is possibility of some severe weather in our area for this morning. So keep it tuned here to AM 580. And we'll let you know what we know just as soon as we do. Well, pardon us there for the interruption there, Professor McCann. I was asking about Mr. López Obrador and where he is on the political spectrum, and particularly the arguments that his opponents advance, that this man is a leftist in the mold of some other South American leftists, and he's not the man that we want to lead Mexico. How does one evaluate that kind of argument?
Well, let me suggest a couple of things. As you were saying, he's really not, his defenders would say he's not in that mold, and López Obrador himself would certainly affirm that. He comes from the Party of the Democratic Revolution, which was an offshoot following the 1988 election. Some disgruntled elements within the ruling party, some left of center elements, decided to form a new political party, and López Obrador was among the leaders of that new party. So he comes from a position on the ideological spectrum that is most certainly left of center, and by that, that would mean he favors a larger state apparatus for social welfare. He would want to see more generous benefits for poor people, larger pensions. He has expressed a certain wariness about being too close to the United States. So that's what sort of left of center means in the Mexican context. But that said, if you look at what the PRD, that's the Party of the Democratic Revolution, if you look at their party manifesto and sort of code it the way political scientists do in terms of left and right, and if you look at the activists who will go to PRD conventions and so on, it's pretty clear that they are to the left of Andres Manuel López Obrador. What López Obrador has tried to do, and I haven't seen this comparison made in news reports, so you know, it might be a little too creative on my part, but he's sort of trying to find that third way, like a Tony Blair. As a left of center spokesperson, he has come out and committed to increasing spending for the poor. I think he even said by 20% if he's elected president, and he wants to build new schools and refineries. You know, he's taken a clear stand against the United States and the Americans' wall-building efforts, you know, to seal off the border and so on. And he did. He has a record of doing such things in Mexico City. As mayor of Mexico City, he did give larger subsidies to single moms and to the elderly. He even tried to improve the bus system to deal with the horrible traffic problems. And he built big highways. So he's big into public works projects. And he left office late last year with an approval rating something like in the neighborhood of 80%, you know, just astoundingly high. So so he may be left of center, but that doesn't mean he's unpopular, certainly. And he has styled himself as being a very conventional kind of left of center person. So in no way, he said, would he repudiate NAFTA. He said he might want to renegotiate some of the parts of the treaty, but he has repudiated any connection to Hugo Chavez, or he's not going to be doing the things that Morales in Bolivia has been doing in terms of taking property, nationalizing property, and the like. So he's, I guess I would say, you know, I likened him to the third way. To me, that means sort of like a Tony Blair type figure, you know, somebody who comes out of the left, but is highly sensitive to what the traffic will bear. And López Obrador himself said that he realizes, you know, as a neighbor to the United States, as a trading partner, the reality is that the futures are linked, and he committed to working constructively with the Americans. He's not going to you know, take away investments, nationalize investments, and the like. So so he's tried to really moderate his stance, so much so that, in fact, the Zapatista subcomandante Marcos and others who, you know, really do want to take away, you know, totally reinvent the state apparatus, they've come out and said really hostile things about López Obrador at their conventions. I mean, not only are they not supporting López Obrador, but they've really, really attacked him in some of the most negative ways. So so I think, you know, maybe if we want to think of him as a sort of in the social democratic mold, perhaps, or at least that's the way he's styling himself.
We talked a little bit earlier about the fact that when President Fox, when Vicente Fox was elected in 2000, this was an historic event as far as Mexico was concerned, because it broke the power of the PRI that had been the dominant party for such a long time. Now, the PRI is fielding a candidate this time around who is in third place behind the two men that we've talked about. I don't think that anybody expects that he has any chance at all of being elected. And in fact, some of the things that I have read suggest that people believe that we're really seeing the end of the PRI what will be the ultimately unsuccessful campaign of Roberto Madrazo. What happened to the PRI, and what was its defeat in 2000 so significant that it in the long run it ended up destroying the party?
Well, to start out with responding to your first point, yeah, Roberto Madrazo is down in the polls, but he's been holding rather steady in the upper 20s, thereabouts. He started out a little bit higher at the beginning of this year. He's dipped. I'm just paraphrasing, you know, many polls. And in the current reading, he's clocking in somewhere around 25 to 30%. And interestingly, you would think in the home stretch now of the campaign, a lot of those people would bail on him to go to one of the more competitive candidates. That doesn't seem to be happening. I mean, there's still time for that, of course. But I think what that suggests is that the mobilization apparatus that's a kind of holdover from the old pre days is still intact. I mean, the PRI is still a significant force at the state and local level, and in the Mexican Congress as well. But really, at the state and local level, I believe it's 17 out of the 32 Mexican states are governed by PRI figures, and something like two-thirds of the municipalities are governed by PRI figures. So it's still, like, really the only truly national party in Mexico. And so when you have something like that set up, and when it's there for 70 years, it doesn't go away overnight. And so I imagine it'll still be there. But you raise a really interesting question. You know, what happened in 2000? And it seemed like, you know, it's just a bolt of lightning out of the blue that the once, you know, the longest-lived ruling party all of a sudden collapsed. The reality, I think, is the collapse was a long time coming. You could see cracks in the party at least from the 80s. And some people suggest even earlier than that, there was a real legitimation crisis beginning in the late 1960s and the 70s as the party responded to different social movements and concerns through more repressive tactics. It lost a lot of legitimacy. And certainly by the late 80s, when Carlos Salinas de Gortari in 1988 took power, he did so under a serious cloud. There were very credible charges of just rampant fraud. And the left of center candidate figure, Cuauhtemoc Cárdenas, who had broken off from the PRI, established this new party, the PRD, and that was a very significant, and along with López Obrador and other figures on the left, which represented a rupture in the ruling party. Throughout the 1990s, you could see the PAN party, the National Action Party, growing in strength, slowly getting more and more state-level governorships. In 1997, the ruling party lost majoritarian control of the Congress, the federal Congress. So that was and it's just a few years later, then they lost the presidency. So, you know, it was a long time coming, I think we recognized it, what was already in place for many years, with the loss of the presidency, the PRI's loss of the presidency. But it's down, and Madrazo himself is certainly down in the polls compared to the other two. But it's not out. Curiously, it's not out the game here in Mexico because it's still got this carryover, this organizational infrastructure across the country.
Well, let's talk with a caller here. We have someone who'd like to join the conversation in Urbana. This is line one. Hello.
Good morning. I don't really know anything about Mexican politics, but from what I've seen, candidates always seem to be male, and I was wondering if you could talk about the role of women in Mexican politics, and I will hang up and listen offline.
All right. There actually is one woman who is among the top few candidates.
Mm-hmm. Right. Her name is Patricia Mercado, she's representing a social democratic and a farmer's party. She's way down. I mean, there are actually five candidates on the ballot. She is one of two candidates who are only polling in the single digits. She is representing what Americans would recognize as, I think, more, you know, a definite liberal or a left platform, pushing for abortion rights and you know, other, you know, kinds of feminist issues. So there is a voice out there, but it's a minor voice. And so the caller is quite right, you know, that it still is rather male dominated.
All right. And anything else that you could add to that about the potential for women to be involved, and not only just say behind the scenes, but actually as candidates?
Well, there was a time actually. It's hard to know how much of this was just a media creation, but the wife of Vicente Fox evidently toyed with the idea of running herself for president. And you know, it wasn't clear how much of that was true and how much of it was just rumor or, you know, the gossip mill. But behind the scenes, of course, what you see is with the social groups that are so integral to political parties and political networking, women play a profoundly important role in church networks and in sort of grassroots politicking. So in that sense, at the sort of activist level, women perhaps, you know, in some ways more significantly than men, may have a political role. But in general, in Mexico, if you just compare kind of levels of political interest in the campaigns, women tend to be a little bit less engaged in politics than the average Mexican male. And some of that may be due to just general upbringing, you know, habits that women are taught not to be so sort of out there in public.
Questions certainly welcome here in this part of Focus 580 as we continue to talk with James McCann. He is Associate Professor of Political Science at Purdue University. We're talking about Mexican politics and particularly the upcoming presidential election that's set for July 2nd. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. We talked about the fact that in the Calderon camp, they would like to encourage people to think that Mr. Lopez Obrador is some kind of a left-wing radical, and that he would take the country in the direction that we have seen other leftist South American political leaders to take. And it is, I think, here in the United States, among people who express opinion, who are attached to government, the preference would be to have the continuity of the PAN continuing to be the power in the presidency. And so the United States here, I think, would like to see Mr. Calderon win. As far as, and admittedly here, I'm doing what we always do here in the United States and say, well, what is it to us? If Mr. Lopez Obrador was elected president of Mexico, as far as the United States was concerned, would that make a big difference?
It's hard to see what difference it would make given what Lopez Obrador has said so far. I mean, there may be some questions raised about NAFTA that would not otherwise get raised. There might be a bit more overt criticism of U.S. immigration policies with a Lopez Obrador presidency. You know, one thing that's sort of impressed me about perhaps Lopez Obrador, but say a Tony Blair or others in that mold, is that you can get pragmatic pretty quickly. So even if there's not any natural rapport, say, between the Bush administration and Lopez Obrador, that may not stand in the way of dealing with common issues having to do with labor and migration or the environment or economics.
We have some other callers to talk with. Let us talk next with someone in Aurora. This is line number one. Hello.
This is not a question about the presidency, but I was interested in knowing if the United States has most states have a rule that you have to stay in high school until 16 or 18 years old. Does Mexico have any law that states that the students of Mexico have to stay in high school?
Well, it's no law as such, but one thing that is striking about Mexico is, at least in terms of official statistics, the vast majority of Mexicans have at least a primary level education. I mean, compared to other Latin American countries or developing countries, the claim is that literacy is rather high, relatively high.
Really? But you're saying it's higher than most other countries.
Well, sure.
What is it compared to the United States?
Oh, it doesn't reach the level of literacy in the United States.
Could I ask?
Yeah, I unfortunately couldn't tell you offhand what the literacy rate is. That's
Do they have to stay in school till they're 16?
Well, there's access to public education, the expectation the students stay in school, but as, you know, there are people drop out, and, you know, especially in the rural areas, and especially in areas that send a lot of migrants north, you don't see, you know, compliance with that. You don't see people staying in school necessarily until they're 16.
Well, I guess I feel that if the people are educated, there might be an opportunity for other than the rich to become president.
Yeah, sure. Well, I think the education issue, you know, if we want to get back to the campaign, that's been one of the salient issues. The major candidates have talked in their own way about expanding schools, increasing the funding for teachers and building more university resources and the like. So, yeah, I think the consensus for the major candidates is that that's a place that needs investment.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for the call. We have, in this part of Focus 580, maybe about 10 minutes left. Our guest is James McCann. He is Associate Professor of Political Science at Purdue, and we're talking about Mexico and the elections that will be taking place there in a little bit more than a week. People will be voting for the president of Mexico, and that man, and it will be a man, will be the president for the next 6 years. That's the term of the president. You're going to get one term in Mexico, so they certainly would be in a position to have great influence over the direction of the country in the next 6 years, and questions are welcome. Let me just real quickly mention that we do have some severe weather moving through our coverage area this morning, and I just took a look at the radar, and it looks like we do indeed have some severe storms up in north, sort of the north eastern part of Champaign County and the northwestern part of Vermilion, and also parts of Ford and Iroquois. And there is still a severe thunderstorm warning that will be in effect. Well, that has just apparently just expired for southeastern Ford County. That was in effect until 10:45, and I do believe that there was one other. The fact is that there is the possibility of severe weather, and we actually have already seen some, so we do want you to keep aware of what's going on. Keep attuned here to the station. If we have further warnings, we'll let you know. Otherwise, there also is a severe thunderstorm watch for parts of central and northern Illinois and all of the northern half of Indiana that will be in effect all the way until 2 o'clock this afternoon central time. Our meteorologist, Ed Kieser, is keeping an eye on the weather. And again, if we have some warnings for you, we will pass them along. We will continue here to talk with callers who are listening. And let's go next to Urbana, and that's line number 2. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. Recently, I learned that high-powered American political consultants were involved with the major candidates you've been talking about. I don't remember enough to be specific, but I was really surprised by that. I would expect any of the major candidates in Mexico to assert their independence from the United States. Could you discuss their effectiveness and how they were received when the word got out? And I'll hang on and listen on the radio.
Okay, thanks for the call.
Yeah, good observation. One of the things that I guess is underappreciated in this country is, part of bringing democracy to the world, I guess, is that all of the major political consulting firms in this country do a lot of work internationally. And in Mexico, in fact, there were American political consultants in 2000 who were either covertly or overtly prepping the candidates, doing strategy sessions, looking over TV spots and things like that. So in that sense, in Mexico, what we've seen is the campaign process looking more and more Americanized, for better or worse. That is the, in the form, the campaigning would look very familiar, I think, aside from, it being in Spanish with different candidates and slightly different issues. The form of the campaigning looks fairly Americanized. There were a couple of live televised debates There are TV spots, the 30-second, the 60-second spots, that are highly focused on individual candidates and personalities, just like in the United States. There's an awful lot of mudslinging, which would be extremely familiar to American viewers. There is an American consultant kind of presence down in Mexico, as in many different countries. But the caller makes a good point that at the same time, and this may sound puzzling, each of the candidates is trying to stick up in their own way for Mexico, or, you know, nobody wants to look like they're somehow tied too closely to the United States or turning their back on Mexico's interests. So the consultants are not going to be, you know, widely seen. You're not going to see them on podiums and so on, along with the candidates.
Well, you know, this is interesting because we also did come across an article, and this was one that was appeared in the New York Times, talking about the Federal Election Institute in Mexico and about the fact that they actually have gotten involved in trying to rein in campaign advertising, and that there have been planned campaign spots that they had told, they said, no, you can't run because of what they said. And apparently they also said to the president, Mr. Fox, that he was not supposed to get involved and interfere in the campaign and was not supposed to go out on the stump for his party's candidate, which, according to this article, would be, you know, something along the line of if in the United States Bill Clinton had been told that he couldn't campaign for Al Gore.
Right, isn't that? I
was amazed. I was just amazed by that.
You don't see that in the United States. And in the U.S., we are certainly no holds barred, right? I mean, it's just every person for himself or herself in debating. But, yeah, that is one thing that makes Mexico distinctive. It's that the Federal Electoral Institute, since the 1990s, has taken on a greater role than anything you'd see in the United States to manage the kind of discourse and the conduct of the campaigns, so that this electoral institute known as IFE, I-F-E, does all that you're saying. In fact, over the Christmas holiday, the IFE declared a truce in campaigning. So it tried to suspend political campaigning shortly after the major parties nominated their candidates. And try doing that in the United States. I mean, it would never happen. And in fact, in Mexico, it wasn't a very successful truce. It was widely violated. But nevertheless, the very idea that you could do such a thing might be curious to Americans. Furthermore, campaigning stops at the end of this month. The election, though, as you say, is July 2nd. The idea is that you want a cooling off period. Mm-hmm. Okay, so there won't be any television advertising or open air rallies and the like. And the IFE has negotiated recently, just this past week, a little pact among the major candidates so that the candidates commit to respecting the results. Okay, and that's something that you never really see in the United States. The idea being that if somebody loses, they will not directly mobilize in the streets then. Hmm. And given the 2000 election was remarkably free of at least major fraud, but you don't have to go real far back in Mexico's history to find instances of serious fraud. So what the IFE has tried to do is legitimate process as much as possible and oversee it in sort of to be that impartial third party out there who can kind of regulate campaign discourse. You know, interestingly, here's another thing that, I mean, if you want to put a finer point on it, they've even tried to micromanage the sayings and campaign advertisements, and they haven't been terribly successful, but the IFE has a statute that says defamatory rhetoric can't appear in political advertisements, so that when Calderon said in one advertisement that López Obrador represented a danger to Mexico, okay, that was ruled as off limits, right? He was told to pull that ad, they try to kind of it's almost a little bit like the FCC trying to define obscenity in this country, or so. You know, there's a lot of judgment call, and Only there, it's happening in the thick of a campaign season, which is a very curious thing. Because, of course, in the United States, it's, you know, you can say anything about anybody, and it's been that way throughout American history. You can go back to the election of 1800 that Thomas Jefferson competed in, and the most outrageous charges were raised every which way about, you know, as far back in our history as 1800 about.
Yeah.
You know, so negative campaigning is certainly nothing new in the United States. And in Mexico, I think there's a good amount of wariness about it.
Well, let's take another caller here. Let's go to Champaign. This is line three. Hello.
Hi. How about, like in Mexico, the open-air campaigning? The presidents will meet in the plazas, and there'll be like 100,000, 200,000 people assembled to hear him speak. We don't have anything like that in the United States. It's way much more controlled here than it is there. And then how about the possibility that the massacre of the students right before the Olympics back in the 70s, how that impacted on the PRI at the national level? It seems like there's still a tremendous amount of resentment against the PRI party for hushing that up and not being honest and forthcoming with the people on that one.
Yeah, good observations. The open-air campaigning, that is definitely something that you see more of in Mexico, and in fact in many emerging democracies and Latin American democracies. There is much more of a tradition of taking demands to the street, and in the old days of the PRI, even a lot of that mobilization was coordinated so that the ruling party would hire buses for the day and give workers the day off work so that they could go into the main square and cheer on the candidates and so on, which, as the caller says, yeah, that's not real common in the United States. We try to simulate that to a certain extent with the party conventions and the like, but, yeah, nothing like the open-air campaigning. The second point, though, about the 1968, in advance of the Olympics, the student massacres and so on, yeah, I think that that's the kind of thing I was suggesting before that provoked a kind of legitimacy crisis for the ruling party. Prior to 1968, the party had been rather successful at keeping the lid on and slowly incorporating, peacefully, more or less, incorporating different groups and interests. But 68 really exposed a sort of violent streak in that strategy. And I think really then there, many elements in Mexico just washed their hands of the ruling party.
Let's go to line number one, Champaign County. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to kind of beg to differ on this characterization of the Mexican electorate as being conservative generally, because you're allowed that there was a lot of fraud. And I think if the PRD had won at the pivotal time when the election was stolen, we might not have had NAFTA. We could envision the countryside not being decimated and less immigrants being forced to leave Mexico because basically Midwestern corn being dumped there in the infrastructure, et cetera. But that's another issue entirely. But I also wanted to just point that out, that I think the world, if those elections hadn't been stolen, the history would have been written quite a bit differently, quite possibly. I wanted you to comment on the attack on the little shanty town that was yearly built in Oaxaca and the Zocalo there. I can't remember if that was a pre-governorship that did that, but the stage was set by Calderon attacking the teachers' unions, and two people died there. So this is more recent, certainly not as the scale of the attack on the students at the time of the Olympics in '68, I guess it was. But,
well, let's get it. We only got a couple
right,
minutes. Let's get a comment from
track the time.
Yeah,
right.
Let's get a comment from the guest. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, sure. Interesting observations. First, just regarding the comment I made before about conservative, I was talking about that really in the classical small c sense, in terms of resistance to change. The caller, it seems to me, is thinking about it in terms of, as well, what is the appropriate role of the state or justice issues and the like. And I think, yeah, I would not disagree with the caller that, to be risk averse, yes, I think there is a certain risk averseness there. But at the same time, when you look at what the polls suggest or what everyday conversations suggest, the issue of inequality and poverty And so on. You know, those are big issues. An earlier caller asked about literacy and so on, and I didn't have that in front of me, but things I do know off the top of my head is that, according to the UN, about 1 out of 10 Mexicans lives on $1 a day or less, and about 5% are deemed to be undernourished or, you know, to be in a food scarcity situation, and those are not small numbers. So there is a remarkable amount of poverty, and Mexicans are quite sensitive to that and want remedies. So, and those are issues that would resonate with a López Obrador and certainly resonated with the PRD from its beginning. So so I think, you know, candidates in Mexico have to, candidates of the left need to walk, you know, what might be kind of a fine line by representing those values having to do with economic development and social justice, while at the same time promising a sort of stable or measured trajectory of change. I mean, that would be, anyway, judging by the survey indicators, that would be sort of the strategy that would be wise to follow. In terms of the more recent bloodshed, that's... the recent event that's made the papers is a sort of, you know, hopefully it doesn't foreshadow future unrest, but that that raised the specter of sort of election related violence, and it's really ratcheted up, I think, the level of concern for the candidates and for observers and really, you know, from abroad as well.
There we must stop because we're here at the end of the time. We want to say thanks to our guest, James McCann. He is Associate Professor of Political Science at Purdue University. Professor McCann, thanks very much for talking with us.
Yeah, you're quite welcome, David.